For example, we're going to remember that part of the Christmas story has to do with the persecution of our Savior by Herod the king, who wanted to kill him if possible. And we observe that this has been true of the Jewish people down through the centuries, either individuals or the whole race or ethnic group of Jews, Israel. And the book of Esther in the Old Testament is singularly appropriate to this theme. Now, we've called this the curse, and some of you are aware of curses, either maybe not so much real, but imagine those of us who are interested in sports like baseball are familiar with the curse of the Red Sox. The Boston Red Sox supposedly had a curse on them ever since they sold Babe Ruth to the Yankees. And for, I don't know, 80-some years, they could not win a World Series. In fact, for many years, they couldn't even get in a World Series, let alone win it after they got there. That curse, and I don't believe it was a real curse, but it was broken in 2004. I think they won the series in 04. But the point is that people believe in curses, even if they're not real. But I can assure you that there is at least one real curse, and we've already looked at it at the beginning of this series, the battle for Israel. And it's found in the Abrahamic covenant, first enunciated in Genesis chapter 12. And I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you. And in you, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. Antisemitism is under God's curse. There is a curse on those who are anti-Semitic. Now, I want to, before we pursue this, I do want to give a at least a rough definition of antisemitism. You are not anti-Semitic if you don't agree with everything that the nation of Israel does or with every Jewish individual that you meet. We're not talking about that. We're talking about the persecution of a people. And we're talking about the ultimate end of this, genocide. And down through history, different ones among the Gentile peoples have attempted genocide of the Jews. And it has always worked out for them the same way it worked out in the book of Esther, either to a greater or lesser extent. Let's consider, we're going to have to overview the book of Esther in order to understand all this, but Esther is the example of God's curse on anti-Semitism. Now, the first thing we want to see, and this is a popular phrase today with moviegoers, is God's prequel. That's chapters 1 and 2 of the book of Esther. The main story follows chapter 2, but the first two chapters set up God's working behind the scenes and ahead of time to pre-position his people for what is coming. And none of the people know any of this, neither the Jews themselves nor the Gentiles. But in chapters 1 and 2, we learn how Esther, who is the cousin or the niece, depends on how you render the Hebrew terms there, but she is related to Mordecai, who is the male hero of this story. And they, of course, are both Jewish people who are living in the capital of the Persian Empire. And the Persian Empire at this time stretched from Europe to India. It was the largest empire in the world. And so the emperor, the king of the Persians, is the most powerful ruler on earth at this particular time. And God orchestrates things in such a way that Esther, and that, by the way, is her Persian name. It means star, interestingly enough. But her Hebrew name is Hadassah, and that means myrtle. And so you could call Esther Myrtle. There are ladies who have that name, Myrtle. Well, that was her name. And in Hebrew, that name is Hadassah. So God has orchestrated things so that Esther becomes the queen of the Persian Empire. Now, you understand, she's in and of herself. She's not anyone. She's not even a Persian herself. But she becomes the favorite of Ahasuerus, who is the emperor at this particular time. And I want you to look at chapter 2 for a moment. Chapter 2 and verse 17. And the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she found favor and kindness with him more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. And so here is Esther elevated from total obscurity to being the queen of the Persian Empire. Reminds you a little bit of Joseph in Egypt, doesn't it? Here was a man, Joseph, who was a slave in Egypt and ends up being the ruler under the Pharaoh of Egypt. Here's Esther, not really a slave per se, but a member of a conquered ethnic group whose country is only now being reconstituted under Persian rule, and she becomes queen of Persia. Now, having said all this, one of the things that we want to point out, because this will be important later in the story, no one knows that she's Jewish. Mordecai, who's her guardian, tells her not to reveal her ethnic background. Nobody cares anyway, except in just a moment, one person is going to care. But certainly the king does not care. And so it never comes up, and she never relates that. Now, Mordecai is also prepositioned by God, and I'd like you to look at verse 21 of this same chapter, Esther chapter 2. In those days, while Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, and this Esh must be a popular name because a woman that we'll encounter in a little bit is not named Zeresh, but this character is Teresh. In any event, these two of the king's officials from those who guarded the door became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. But the plot became known to Mordecai, and he told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. Now, when the plot was investigated and found to be so, they were both hanged on a gallows. And gallows figure largely in this story. Apparently this was the favored Persian method of execution. But in any event, they were hanged on a gallows, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the king's presence. So the whole story is written down in the history of his reign. So what happens? And in case all this was maybe a little bit unclear, well, here's what happens, and here's how God gets Mordecai in just the right position for what will follow. Mordecai learns about the plot against the life of the king. And he tells Esther, who is the queen now, and she tells the king, and it's investigated. And by the way, she lets him know that it was Mordecai who discovered the plot. And so it's investigated, the culprits are executed, and the deed is written down, it's recorded. And all this is going to be important. The details are often important. And so when you read your Bible, pay attention to the details. They'll come back to haunt you after a while. They're going to haunt another man that we're introduced to now in chapter 3. So this was God's prequel. And now we're introduced to a fellow named Haman, the Agagite. All right. Hard to render some of these titles, but we're looking at Haman's hatred here. And this is so typical of anti-Semitism, and we'll explain why in just a second. But Haman is high in the king's favor also. Now, who is he really? Well, we don't know. Some have suggested that he is a descendant of the king Agag that Saul, King Saul of Israel, failed to execute as he should have, and thereby lost his kingdom. The titles are the same, but that connection is a wee bit shaky. It could be true, but there was also a Persian province of Agag as well. And so it may just simply mean that he is from that particular Persian province. But in any event, he is elevated by the king, and the king issues the decree that all are to pay homage to him. But Mordecai will not bow down before him. Now, this isn't pride on Mordecai's part. This kind of homage was done to emphasize deity. In other words, you did this and you were basically calling Haman a god. And Mordecai, as a Jew, refused to do this. And so we read, for example, in verse 5, when Haman saw that Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage to him, Haman was filled with rage. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him who the people of Mordecai were. Therefore, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. Now, what you discover here is that the hatred, the anti-Semitism, is irrational. Everybody is bowing down to Haman except one character, and he can't stand it. He can't believe that this fellow will not knuckle under, as the saying goes. And he's enraged. But it goes beyond that. He could very easily have done something to Mordecai alone, but he finds out that Mordecai is a Jew, and again, I suggest irrationally, he decides he's got to destroy all the Jews. It's not enough to destroy Mordecai. He's got to destroy all the Jews. And so there is an irrational hatred that is underlying anti-Semitism. Don't you see that true in our own day? Cast back 70, 80 years to Germany in the 30s and 40s. And with the rise of Hitler and the Nazis, there was an irrational hatred of Jewish people. Hitler blamed the Jews for all the ills of the world. There was no basis for it, but they were an easy target. And so this irrational hatred is built up. The irony here, and I'm getting ahead of the story a little bit, the irony here is that the Jews whom Hitler and Mussolini and the others ran out of Europe, they came to America and built the atomic bomb. Many of these same people were Jewish people. Albert Einstein was a Jew. And many of the others who worked on the development of nuclear weapons, rocket science, all this sort of thing, they came to America or to Britain, as the case might be, and worked on the weapons that destroyed the Axis. And in fact, if Germany had not collapsed when it did, there's some question as to where the first atomic bomb would have been dropped. Might have been dropped on Germany. No one knows, that's just hypothetical, but there you have it. And so here is Haman in our story about Esther, and he is irrational in his hatred. But before we leave this anti-Semitic hatred, look at verse 7 of this same third chapter of Esther. In the first month, which is called the month Nisan, I don't know if that's right pronunciation, it's how you pronounce the car, but this could be Nisan, I don't know how they render this. But in any event, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, Pur, that is the lot, was cast before Haman from day to day and from month to month until the 12th month, that is the month Adar. Now, this word pur or pure, because I think the Jewish holiday is Purim, is how that's pronounced. Purim, okay. Well, however it's pronounced, this means the lot. And what is going on here is that Haman is casting lots. He's soothsaying. He's trying to get the will of the gods here by casting lots. And so he casts the lot until all the numbers come up right. Now, we're not necessarily talking dice here like you and I would understand today. But the point is, he is involved in a form of witchcraft. No surprise there. These are pagan people. And we also take note that he's got his own astrologers. And as I read this story, I often wonder if his wife, Zeresh, is a witch by profession. I don't know, but it sounds like it. In any event, when all the signs are right, that's when he goes with his plot against the Jews to the emperor. And that takes up much of the rest of this chapter. But my point is, not only is anti-Semitism irrational, it has a satanic element to it. Because Satan desires to destroy the Jewish people. We saw that in last week's message with regard to God's protection of Israel down through the years. There's a satanic element to this anti-Semitic attitude that people have. So it's irrational just on a human level. But on a spiritual plane, there's a deeper and darker background. This is satanic in its origin. Well, that's Haman's hatred, and there are those today who hate the Jews. Have you ever, you know, read about anybody in the newspaper or on the television news, you know, Hamas? And I don't know if the words beginning with H are significant or not. I hope not. My last name begins with that letter, but it seems like so many, you know, Haman, Hitler, Hamas, you know, on you could go with people with H's in their name. But in any event, here's Haman, and he hates Mordecai and Mordecai's people. So let's take a look at Mordecai's people, chapter 4 of the book of Esther. What does all this have to do with anti-Semitism? Well, the first verse of that chapter says Mordecai learned all that had been done, and he went into mourning. He tore his clothes, put on sackcloth. Esther hears about this, and she inquires, and Mordecai tells her about this plot. And he says, you know, you need to approach the king about this. And Esther reminds him that no one, not even the queen, can approach the king unless they're summoned. And if they do and they're not summoned, he has to hold out the scepter to them. If he doesn't, they die. They die. This is one of the ways they protected the kings in those days. Maybe the Secret Service here in the U.S. needs to take some lessons. I don't know. But in any event, we're told that Esther is aware of this. Mordecai says, you need to do this. And when she reminds him about the danger involved, if you'll, and this is familiar to many of you, if you look at verse 13, then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this. Who knows? Maybe this is the whole reason why you've come to the kingdom. And maybe it is. You see the faith of this man Mordecai. If you won't do this, relief will come from another quarter. It's not the rest of us that are going to suffer by your refusal. It's just you. Now, Christians need to take a lesson here as well. We're talking about Israel and the Jewish people, but there's a lesson here for Christians and the church as well. God directs us to do something. We say, oh, I can't do that. I won't do that. I'm busy with this. I have no interest in the other, etc., etc. The only throat we're cutting is our own when we refuse God's direction. So, he reminds Esther of this, and then, of course, points out to her, maybe this is the reason God puts you in the place that you're in. What do you think? I think it was. And I'm going to make another application to you and me. You're in the place that you're in because God's put you here. Now, that we can talk about Grace Bible Church. We can talk about Valdosta, Georgia, or wherever it is you live. We can, but wherever you're at, geographically, physically, spiritually, you're there because God's put you there. He has a purpose for you right here, right now. Now, that doesn't mean you're always going to stay here. And most of you sitting here today know of people who've been here for a while and they've gone someplace else. And we understand that. God does move people around. But the point is, you're here today because God's got a purpose for you here today. And so, he reminds Esther of that. What a man is this Mordecai who has a debt. And by the way, many of you are probably aware that Esther is probably the most controversial book in the Old Testament. It's controversial because there's not one mention of God in the book. Not directly. It's inferred, but there's no direct reference to God in the book. Now, I'm going to give you an opinion, and that's all this is. There's no direct mention of God because by the time you get to Esther, you don't have to have a direct reference to God. They all know who God is. Why would they be doing the things that they are doing and preserving their singular nature in all of the peoples of the world if they didn't believe what God said? And going back to that Abrahamic covenant, I have a land for you. I'm going to make a great nation, and I'm going to bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. Was Mordecai thinking about that promise of the covenant when he told Esther, relief and deliverance will arise from another quarter if you refuse to do this? Maybe he was. Well, then Esther, this is verse 15, we've seen what a great man Mordecai is here in his faith. Here's Esther. Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, go assemble all the Jews who are found in Susa, this is the Persian capital, and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maidens also will fast in the same way, and thus I will go into the king, which is not according to the law, and if I perish, I perish. If I die, I die. But you fast. Prayer is not mentioned here. Do you think they just fasted, or do you think they might have done some praying? Well, I think they did. These people knew what it meant to fast and pray. But you fast and pray, I'll go into the king, and if I die, I die. And so Mordecai went away and did just that. What a woman is Esther, and what a woman of faith she is. She knows what has to be done. She knows it might cost her life, but she's going to do it anyway. And so we come finally to almost the end. It's the end for Haman anyway. Haman's hanging. And this takes us into chapter 5. Esther prepares a banquet, and there are only two men invited, the king and Haman. Interesting. Let me just ask you this while we're thinking on this. Would you think that Esther would have invited the king and Mordecai? I would have thought maybe so, but no. She invites Haman. How interesting. Well, that will turn out in just a moment. And so Haman is all excited about this. And so he is quite certain that everything is, just like they sing in Oklahoma, everything's going my way. You know, the sun and the corn is as high as an elephant's eye, and here's Haman, and everything's going my way. He goes home at the end of chapter 5, and he consults with his soothsayers and with his wife Zeresh, and they say, well, what you need to do just to satisfy your vengeance is to build a gallows 50 cubits high. Now, I don't know what a Persian cubit was, but if it's standard length, you're talking about 75 feet high. A 7.5 story gallows, and plan to hang Mordecai on this. And I'm reminded of other genocidal anti-Semites who've planned all these different things. Let me just give you an example from our history. Hitler, he built all those extermination camps, and he killed a lot of Jews. There's no denying that. But where is Hitler and where are the Nazis today? They're all dead and under the ban, as it were. And the Jews have their own homeland. They didn't have that before World War II. And now they're back in the Holy Land. And if anything, there are more Jews today than there were before Hitler started his purge. So Haman builds a gallows. He thinks this is a grand idea. I'll demonstrate to everybody what a man I am. And, of course, he's been invited to the banquet. And he goes to the banquet, and he's invited again the next day. And in chapter 6, we see the beginning of the end. And one of the things that amazes me here is how fast everything turns around for Haman. In chapter 5, everything is going great for the hater of the Jews in Israel. And in chapter 6, it's like he's fallen off a cliff. Because during the night, the king has a dream. Or rather, he doesn't have a dream, but he can't get to sleep. And so he gets people to read to him. Now, I don't know what you read when you can't get to sleep at night, but he has them read about him. He gets the chronicles out, and they read to him. And he comes to that time when these two characters plotted against his life, and Mordecai saved the day. And the king asks, what did we ever do for Mordecai? And his attendants say, nothing.